Do you ever catch yourself saying, English is just crazy? Maybe your students come across a tricky word and you tell them, you just have to memorize that one, or this is the part you have to know by heart. But deep down, you know it's still confusing. Here's the truth. English isn't random. It's a wonderfully complex system, and once you understand how that system works, through sound, structure, and meaning, everything changes. That's what Sarah Paul and I teach inside Mastering Morphology. This isn't another curriculum. It's deep teacher knowledge inside a practical comprehensive course that finally shows you how words really work. No more exceptions, no more gimmicks or patching holes with memorization or phonics alone. It's time to go beyond sound it out and give your students the framework they need to truly understand words. So if you're ready to stop guessing and start teaching with confidence, join us inside Mastering Morphology. Enrollment is open now, so we invite you to click the link in the show notes to get started. You're listening to episode 57 of Literacy in Color. Welcome to a very special series here on Literacy in Color. October is Dyslexia Awareness Month, and every Friday this month, I'll be releasing a bonus episode dedicated to understanding dyslexia and supporting students who are affected by it. Be sure to check out the link in the show notes for the full dyslexia awareness playlist so you don't miss an episode. We're kicking off this series with an episode entitled, What Does Dyslexia Really Look Like and What Can We Do About It? With my guest Heather O'Donnell from New Paltz Multisensory Tutoring. She is certified at the associate level with the Orton Gillingham Academy, as well as a certified Wilson dyslexia practitioner. After years of experience in both special and general education settings, Heather left the classroom in 2018 to open New Paltz Multisensory, an in-person and online tutoring practice in New Paltz, New York. Beyond tutoring, New Paltz Multisensory has expanded into creating structured literacy and multisensory math materials for teachers, and in 2024 launched a Dyslexia Parent Toolkit, an online membership designed to equip parents with the knowledge and resources they need to support their child's literacy journey. I'm so excited for this conversation. We're diving into what dyslexia really looks like, what signs teachers and parents should be aware of, and most importantly, what we can do about it. Welcome to the Literacy in Color podcast. I'm your host, Michelle Sullivan, a science of reading advocate with over a decade of experience as a reading interventionist and literacy coach. I'm passionate about making evidence-based instruction both effective and engaging. If you're interested in captivating our learners on reading fluently and understanding language, or as I like to call it, keeping it colorful, then you've found the right place. Each week, we'll explore intriguing lit bits and practical strategies around the science of reading and structured literacy to help you be colorful and teach colorfully. Are you ready to bring literacy to life? Let's color outside the lines and make an impact together. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Literacy in Color. I am so excited to be joined by my good friend, Heather O'Donnell. She is a true dyslexia expert. And today we're going to demystify dyslexia a bit for educators and for parents in exploring some of the early signs and the importance of intervention and the power of structured literacy targeting our dyslexic learners. So first of all, welcome to the show, Heather.
Hi, Michelle. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm really excited to be here.
You're welcome. And I'm so excited to have you here. This time last year, we were at the Reading League together. I'm so sad that we aren't able to recreate that, but I'm so happy to be chatting with you today. So can you share a little bit about your background and how you came to focus so much of your career on supporting students with dyslexia?
Sure. So I am a New York State certified special education and general education teacher. I've always felt that I've had two passions in education, autism and special ed, and dyslexia, which is not unrelated to special ed. And as a classroom teacher, I was primarily a self-contained classroom teacher. I worked a lot with kids with autism. And then several things happened in the summer of 2018. I left the classroom and I decided to pursue my other passion of working with kids with dyslexia. I'm a Wilson certified dyslexia practitioner. I'm SERI certified, and I'm also certified with the Orton-Gillingham Academy at the associate level, which means I really love to learn about reading and dyslexia. And I spend a lot of time learning and honing in on one of my passions. And in the practice, not only do we work with kids who have dyslexia, but we also are working with kids who have ADHD and autism and special needs diagnoses, because many times when you have co-occurring conditions, dyslexia and autism, it's hard to find schools and resources that support. So it's a badge of pride for me as a special needs mom myself that we work with kids who have special needs in addition to dyslexia.
Yeah, you are such a blessing in this world. You do so many good things. And oh goodness, I can think about all of the parents who are struggling with multiple diagnoses and not knowing where to go and what outlets to tap into. So resources like yours are really special. So thank you for all the work that you do.
Oh, I love it. Trust me. When a kid walks through the door, they are just a kid. Every kid who's struggling with reading needs the help, structured literacy instruction that they need to be successful. And it is something really exciting to be able to provide that.
Yeah. And all kids can learn. And it's amazing. We just want to make sure that they're not part of a system that's going to fail them. So to give them that support is so important. Let's start out by defining dyslexia in just really clear parent-friendly terms or teacher-friendly terms.
That is such a big ask, right? So traditionally, I go to the International Dyslexia Association definition of dyslexia, which defines dyslexia as a specific learning disability that is neurobiological in origin, characterized by difficulties with accurate, fluent word recognition and poor spelling and decoding. And these issues typically come from a deficit in the phonological component of language that's unexpected in relation to other cognitive abilities. That's not very parent-friendly or teacher-friendly, but basically a kid with dyslexia is a kid who typically is really bright, has a great oral vocabulary, tells you amazing stories, listens to grade-level text, and can answer comprehension questions, but then when it's reading time, they struggle, and their struggle is unexpected. And that is one of the challenges for teachers and parents, because they look at this bright academic, you know, achieving kid with all these possibilities, and then they're like, but why are you having so much difficulty reading? And that can often lead to feelings of they're just not trying hard enough, or if they just work harder, they'll get it. And I, you know, my heart breaks every time I talk to a prospective client and I hear those words, because in many ways that I have found in my work can be the strongest indicator that a child might need to be evaluated for dyslexia, because that phonological difficulty, the difficulty learning the letter sounds, blending and reading words by putting the letter sounds together. And I think the biggest impact for the kid is they're seeing their peers do these things effortlessly, and they are working often two or three times harder, and it's so much more frustrating and the pace is slower. So in my experience working in the tutoring practice, the kids that are bright and capable but are really struggling with reading with proper instruction in their classroom, those are the ones that teachers and parents should start to think, is it time to start considering dyslexia? Is there something more going on here? Is there a learning disability that's impacting their ability to read? And the sooner that takes place, the better for the student's confidence.
Yeah. Oftentimes when we think about those test batteries, they'll say there's a big discrepancy between the reading ability and then the IQ. And so that's like a telltale sign too that there might be an issue there if you get to that point of the testing.
Absolutely. And also processing speed. I mean, these are the kids for whom reading the word, putting the sounds together, reading the word, and then they turn the page and it's like they've never seen that exact word and they have to start it again. Like these are the kids that homework that should take 20 minutes takes an hour because it just takes them so long and it is so challenging to perform these literacy tasks. But that seems to really stand out in terms of their oral language skills and their vocabulary and things like that. That's when the flag should go up, that either a professional battery, a professional evaluation, or even I tell families to start with the school district, request a complete education evaluation from your school district, which is free. doesn't cost a thing because it's a great way to at least start on the data trail and get some information about your child's learning strengths and weaknesses. And from then, you can start to look at other options.
Yeah, I so appreciate that you just mentioned the processing speed too, because I think oftentimes students with dyslexia can decode. It might be really effortful and they're able to get through, but the automaticity is not there. And the mapping of like holding and storing those words in their brain that is like instantly recognized is not there. And so we need to take into consideration that processing speed too.
Yes, 100%. It's really important to remember that kids with dyslexia are working twice as hard all the time, and it's exhausting. And that's one reason why you see the frustration, and you see they might come home from school and kind of fall apart because they're holding it together and working so hard during the school day.
Yeah, definitely. So maybe we can get into some common signs that you've seen with the students that you've worked with that is a red flag for dyslexia as well.
Absolutely. And these can vary by age. Signs of dyslexia are going to look different for a 3 or 4 year old versus a 6th or 7th grader. And it's important to recognize that. But typically, there is a conception that dyslexia can't be diagnosed until about the age of 7 or 8. And without getting into those specifics, there can be signs even at the preschool level. Kids who have trouble with nursery rhymes, kids who have trouble hearing rhyming words. If you give them 2 words and ask them if they rhyme or end in the same pattern, they have difficulty hearing that. Preschoolers who have difficulty clapping out syllables and words. And often there is some history of a speech delay or speech issue. It's not a requirement. There are plenty of kids out there who have dyslexia who do not have a speech history. But often there's been some speech intervention somewhere that is just a piece of the puzzle, correlated, not causated. By early elementary, kids are struggling to match letters and sounds. You know, they're struggling to remember that P says P, and they're struggling to remember common sight words. Like I mentioned before, you know, they'll read a sight word and then they'll turn the page and it's like they've never seen it before. Like you said, with the orthographic mapping, it's hard for them to secure that knowledge and use it readily. They often avoid reading. These are the kids who might want to go to the nurse or offer to deliver something to another classroom. You know, it's a conscious, this is really hard, I need help. And they will try to escape simply because of the demand of the task. Reading is slow and choppy, and they have a really hard time sounding out those words. And depending on the instruction they're receiving, if they're not receiving a strong phonic space, reading instructions, identifying and sounding out words is going to be even harder for them. And then by the time they move through elementary, like you discussed, reading is slow. It's choppy. It's hard. They're working really hard to figure out these words. And then comprehension is affected because if you're reading word by word and it's really hard to read and you get to the end, the last thing you're going to do is go back and reread it for meaning. So then, you know, the meaning and the content of what the reading starts to get lost. And then by middle school, you know, the demands are so much higher, the extended writing assignments, reading books and longer texts, it just becomes overwhelming and kids really start to struggle and resist reading time and they feel anxious and it just gets really challenging the older students get.
Yeah, and you see it affecting so many different aspects of their life and not just the reading and how it can impact self-esteem and all those types of things as well.
Yes. I mean, in the practice, we work really hard to work with families around things like sports schedules and after school activities, because these are typically areas where kids who struggle with in school shine. And it's really important for their confidence and their sense of self. But it can make scheduling tutoring sessions a little tricky. So we do whatever we can to adjust our schedules as different spring sports season pops up or the winter basketball season suddenly arrives, because we know how important it is for kids to have that area of their life in which they are successful when school is really hard.
Yeah. And I love how you just walked through a lot of signs that we can look for throughout different age levels and grade levels. And maybe, is there an example of anything that might be developmentally appropriate early on in a child's life, but then later on might be considered a red flag as the student gets older?
Absolutely. I think reversals, letter reversals, would be the biggest example that pops into my mind. As kids are learning to write, notoriously the most common letters to be affected by reversals are B and D, although sometimes you'll see P and Q. And again, That's because it's essentially the same letter. It's just around a quadrant and it's facing different ways. So I love to get out the chair. I use the chair example with my students and I show them how a chair is still a chair when it's upside down, but it's looking different and things like that. It's a visual discrepancy. When kids are learning to write in kindergarten, first grade, reversals are fairly common. They usually self-correct and they fade out by second, third grade typically. For kids with dyslexia, that can be a little bit longer. Their brain, again, is having a harder time with the connecting the letters and the letter sounds, and those reversals can persist as a result of that difficulty. And again, like that mapping, that recognition. And so that is something, you know, when parents hop on consults with me and we talk about reversals in fourth grade, it's like, okay, that's another piece of the puzzle. Does it mean the child has dyslexia? No, but it's certainly a flag that indicates someone in the family had difficulty learning to read. We're talking about reversals. The child doesn't enjoy reading and often avoids it. Homework time is a nightmare. It starts to paint a picture of possible dyslexia, whether or not there is a diagnosis.
What is one of your go-to ways to remedy that in upper elementary when you see those kinds of reversals?
There are so many strategies, and I will be honest, I have not found one that works for every kid. I've experimented with the hands, you know, the BD hand, because the advantage of that is a student always has their hands. However, I have found teaching both is confusing. Sometimes it's better for a student to learn one. This is your B hand. They wear a watch. The left hand, that's your B hand. And if you can recognize that, then you can see if it matches the D. I took a professional development at the Windward School in White Plains, New York, way back when, gosh, almost 10 years ago. And one of the professors had a strategy that she recommended. She said, have the kid make a beautiful picture of one of the letters, like have them pick B or D, turn into an art project, get out the glitter glue, get out the feathers, sequins, you know, the whole thing. And she claimed in the process of doing that, that would help cement it and they wouldn't struggle. I've played around with that. I haven't found it to work 100%. I personally don't have the wall visuals of the B. You know, sometimes there's the bat and the diaper and things like that. I tend to go with the hands because, again, kids always have their hands. So if they're reading or doing homework somewhere without those visuals, it can be a struggle. You know, after years of a brain looking at a letter a certain way, it is not an easy perception to change.
Yeah, definitely. And I appreciate you talking about how not every strategy works for every kid. And I think that's one of the beauties of structured literacy, is that it's not necessarily one size fits all. It's an approach to instruction, and we need to tap into that teacher toolbox to see what's going to work for that particular kid while still being really explicit with a lot of practice. And one of my favorite things for BD is tapping into mouth articulation. And this, you know, cements into the handwriting as well, how when you form the letter B, your mouth starts out in a closed position, right? Mm-hmm. And so we start with a straight line down first, and then we do our open circle, and then your D sound is starting out with an open mouth. So we start with the circle first. So leaning into that as well is just another tip to add to your teacher toolbox. Yeah. I love the B hand. That's one of my favorites as well. I feel like I used that most frequently when I was reading interventionists.
I have been working with some kids this summer, in particular with the C to the D, like coaching them start with the C and then go into the D just to break up that line down. That has worked really well for some students, I will say. So same, exactly what you're describing with the open, just I've called it Z to the D. It depends on the child, and it depends on, again, how entrenched that visual perception is. There are tons of strategies out there, and as soon as you find one that works, you stay with it.
Yeah, definitely. And we don't have to throw every strategy at a kid. It's like start with one, see if it sticks.
Yes, absolutely.
It's not teaching every single strategy at the same time. So are there any signs that maybe parents might notice at home that a teacher might not pick up on, or vice versa, when we think about signs of dyslexia?
I think the biggest one is homework, how homework time goes, and students' willingness to read. I mean, there is a research-based recommendation, read to your child, read often, and that is wonderful and 100% true. But often by the time I'm sitting down with a prospective client, they're like, well, we're reading to my child and my child loves it, but they're not reading. Like, they're not able to read back. They don't want to read. We'll read Harry Potter or whatever, and it's great. But when it's time to read what they're bringing home from school, it's a totally different story, and it's a struggle. So I think that kind of mismatch is a window that parents have that teachers may not necessarily gain access to in a busy classroom. And if that is the case, I think that is something that absolutely should be talked about, you know, the first parent-teacher conference, or even consider requesting a meeting, because that is a big mismatch, because classrooms are busy and teachers work hard to read with small groups and read with kids, but it could be harder to notice a student's struggle with reading tasks at their level in a busy classroom, and a parent might gain that access and insight a little bit faster, because that is often something I hear from prospective clients about their child's love of reading when someone else is reading, but how hard it is for them to read themselves.
Yeah. And so many times I think about those students who, when you do your read aloud, they're the most insightful ones and wanting to share all of the things that they noticed about the text. And that, again, it goes back to that whole IQ, like very bright. And then when it comes to having to lift the words off the page, there becomes like this avoidance too.
Yeah. And it makes sense. I mean, you know, I avoid things I don't want to do that are really hard. We all do it. But, you know, unfortunately for a young kid who's struggling with learning to read, that's what school is. You can't really escape it. And that's when it starts to become overwhelming and they really start to become frustrated by being in school.
Yeah. Yeah. And then are there any less obvious signs that often get overlooked?
I mean, I will be honest. I talk to people who are already concerned. I think spelling often lags, even with appropriate instruction. Kids who have dyslexia often decode at a higher level than they spell. When we spell a word, we own it. We understand all the aspects of it. So even with appropriate instruction, that skill can lag behind, because again, it also involves writing, particularly at the lower part of elementary school. When we write a word, we have to not only know what letters we want to write, we have to remember the formation of how to make those letters, and we have to remember which letters go together to make a word and things like that. So the executive functioning task is much higher. So a child who perhaps reads at a higher level, but who's struggling so much more with spelling or writing tasks is another flag, again, just because of that mismatch and assuming that they are receiving the instruction that they need, that gap can show a potential issue. I really think that in my experience, I'm sure there are plenty of other experiences. I haven't worked with every kid out there, obviously. But the biggest thing is that child who's so capable and, you know, loves so much about school, but then reading time comes and everything is just so much harder. And then when that spills over at home and, you know, they're really struggling to do the things that are coming home, if there's homework and they don't want to take a turn reading, those have sort of been the biggest flags. And then again, as I mentioned, when I talk to parents, oh, you know, grandma had a hard time learning to read, or, oh, I'm dyslexic, or my husband's dyslexic. You know, usually there's someone else in the family, because traditionally dyslexia is genetic and it does run through families. So that can be another correlation, not necessarily a causation, but another check as the possibility is being explored.
Yeah. You know, I think back to prior generations, so much probably just went undiagnosed and it was just, you were seen as the poor reader and that was it. And then you owned that identity and
yes,
coped in some sort of way.
Yeah. And I think this is one aspect where technology can be helpful, because now with voice to text, you know, kids who struggle with writing can get their ideas out in different forms than they could have in, you know, the past. But it still takes editing. It still takes an ability to read what is written and put it together in terms of grammar and things like that. You know, voice to text isn't perfect. It'll pick up random words or construct words inappropriately. So as I always encourage families to teach kids to type, especially kids with dyslexia, like old school, real typing, because I think as kids move out of elementary school, typing, oh, it was true when I was in school a long time ago, and now I think it's even more true. Like, being able to type, being able to take what you're thinking and put it out quickly and efficiently through typing is the best tool that we can give our kids who struggle with reading, spelling, and writing because it will help them tap into the technology of grammar correct and spell correct and things like that so that they can communicate. I mean, I know for myself, I'd much rather type something than write it, handwrite it at this point. And I think that's true. Even more so for this generation of kids.
Several times you talked about the importance of early intervention and how that's really crucial for supporting our dyslexic learners. So what happens when a student with dyslexia perhaps doesn't get intervention right away?
It's really hard. It's hard when kids slip through the cracks. They get frustrated. School is not a fun place because when you think about it, there's an expression, K to two is learning to read, and then grades three to five is reading to learn. So if you're having reading difficulties and writing difficulties and spelling difficulties, as you move through elementary school, the demands shift. You're handed a book and expected to read it. And yes, again, this is where technology can be wonderful. Audiobooks are fantastic for helping out kids who struggle. But then you go to social studies class and you're reading a text about early explorers or whatever. And then you go to science and you're learning about space. The expectation of reading and interpreting written language infiltrates the entire school day. And when it's really hard, when you're not on grade level and you're struggling with reading, it just becomes overwhelming for kids. And they often become frustrated. They often become less confident, depressed. It can be really a challenging place to be. And again, kids are painfully aware. I mean, they can see their peers doing all these things that they're struggling with. I love it when we get a younger reader in the practice who, you know, a parent is like, I just feel like they need a little more support, but it doesn't happen too often. We tend to get more third, fourth, fifth graders when they're already struggling and they're already feeling bad about themselves. And what happens is that the road is just longer. You know, we have to go back, identify the missing skills and fill them in. And that can be really challenging for a fifth grader who's struggling to have to go back to what they perceive as first grade work or kindergarten type words. When a family is concerned, when a teacher is concerned, the sooner at least a school evaluation can take place, more information about how a kid is learning, the better, because it is just a tough road when that early intervention window is missed. And it's tough for families, it's tough for the kid involved, and it's challenging for teachers. It's really hard to meet many learning needs in one classroom. And the system works better when kids get the help they need as soon as possible.
Yeah, 100%. And we know here that structured literacy is such a game changer, and it plays such a crucial role for supporting all learners, really, but especially those for whom reading doesn't come easily. So we know that early intervention is so important. Can you share maybe some results you've seen when students do receive the right type of support early on?
Oh my goodness, it can be such a game changer. You know, I have one student that we worked with in my mind. She came to us and she was at 14% for her age, you know, in terms of her reading abilities. She started with us, it was actually during COVID time. She worked with one of our tutors for a full year, three times a week. And when we reassessed her, she was at the 84th percentile for her age. And even in our work, it's rare that we get such a clear, we started here, we ended here snapshot. It's just miraculous to watch. You know, I worked with a student, I'm actually still working with them, and we started at CBC words. I mean, this student literally could not read. And now, 2 years later almost, they are reading everything. And I was lucky enough, they sent me a story that they're working on just yesterday, actually. And I was just so amazed to see how far they've come. And, you know, using adverbs, using adjectives, like building out these complex sentences, you know, they know all the syllable types. We've worked on morphology. And it's just amazing to see, because when you're in it session by session, you don't necessarily see the progress. But when you look back, you know, when I look back at that first assessment I gave the student in September of 2023, and then I look where we are now, it's just amazing to see the growth. Those are the two that come to mind off the top of my head. It's so important. And in my experience, I have found that kids welcome the help for the most part. When school is so frustrating and overwhelming, to get someone, you know, I like to describe structured literacy as like a layer cake. You know, we work on one layer. We teach it, we practice it, we master it, and then we add another one, but we come back. You know, the layers are never gone. We do the spiral review, and that just builds kids' confidence, because instead of being handed a book with all these untaught concepts that they don't know how to read, they start to feel successful because it is the instruction that they need to feel successful and to make the growth that they desperately want.
And like Anita Archer says, that success breeds motivation.
Yes.
And then instead of having a downward spiral, we have that upward spiral of let's continue this great work. And I love how you talked about the magic in seeing the light bulb click and for things actually working for the student when you use the right type of instruction. So I love that analogy of the layer cake. It's very sweet.
That's a love cake, right?
Yeah, everyone loves cake. So can you talk about some of the key components of strong literacy instruction when we're considering structured literacy practices? Like what might one of your tutoring lessons look like?
Absolutely. So again, I started primarily doing Wilson. These days I'm following more Orton-Gillingham, but I'll switch depending on the student. You know, there I think Wilson is a fantastic program and I love Orton-Gillingham approach, you know. I like to mix it up. But in the traditional Orton-Gillingham lesson, as I've learned from my fellow, we start off with a multisensory or kinesthetic warm-up, perhaps a handwriting letter or an irregular word instruction. We will do a visual drill, which is reviewing letter sounds, you know, A, apple, ah, or A, ah, depending on the student's skill level. We'll do an auditory drill where I will provide the letter sounds and the student will write the letters that make those sounds. We will do a blending drill. We will do phonological awareness. And the student will read words. The student will spell words. The student will read sentences. The student will write sentences. And then I'll teach a new concept. Again, moving through scope and sequence, you know, paying attention to the errors the student made in the lesson before and highlighting those in the next one. And then we'll end with reading connected text. And, you know, initially the connected text will be more decodable and controlled. It'll build off of the new instruction or it'll be a review of skills previously learned. But then as the student's skills progress, we move towards less decodable text and more authentic text. But we'll discuss, you know, meaning and pull out vocabulary words and do all of that. So that's typically how my lessons go these days. And again, it takes time. You know, I definitely talk to families. You know, it's not a quick fix. You know, first we need to assess and see the student's strengths and the areas that need to be filled in. And then we plan our instruction around that. And I work with families often for years, but we build the relationship. And as families see the effect that this instruction has on their students, you know, I'll hear things from families like, they read a street sign. They read a birthday card. She set up her stuffed animals and was the teacher, read them a story. Like those are the things that reassure families, this is what my child needs. I mean, the assessment scores are absolutely important and we want a progress monitor. But as families start to see it spill over into their home life and they start to see their kid taking on the tasks that they used to avoid, that's what's really exciting. And I think we as teachers can all agree that's the goal.
Yeah. And the goal isn't to be good at school, it's to be a good citizen in this world.
Yes, definitely.
No, that's really, really great. Thanks for sharing about your lesson components. And it just goes to show, you know, your structure can remain the same from session to session to session. And the content is going to be different depending on what you're working on. And as you progress through the skills, it's going to be more challenging. But you're still bringing back those pieces from before, so they're not forgotten and really instilled. And I think that's where a lot of the beauty lies too in structured literacy, that practice, practice, practice.
Yes, absolutely. I love to send home decodable texts or send them to families because I see a student for two windows. Unlike a classroom teacher who sees a student every day, you know, I'll see a student once or twice a week for a window, but it has to be more. They have to continue to practice at home. And it takes a village. It takes everyone working together to support the student. And when everything is aligned and the student starts to feel that motivation, it can be really powerful and exciting.
Yeah, definitely. And how much more wonderful would it be if that student was receiving the same type of instruction in the classroom too? So it would be that double dose.
Absolutely. As much as I love the work that I do, I strongly feel many students will be best supported in schools. Tutoring is one more thing. you have a student who does sports, it's one more thing to fit in after school. It's one more ask of a student for whom reading and literacy can be challenging. And that's not to say it doesn't work for a lot of kids. It does. But I 100% believe many kids should just get that support in school so that it's not one more thing for them and that it can be daily and it can build and lead to their success in the classroom as they move through elementary and middle and high school.
Definitely. Well, I know that all of the families that you work with feel so supported by you. So again, kudos to you. And for the parents who are told to wait and see and told, just give them time. What would you say to that parent?
Oh, I so have thoughts on this. I would say, no, thank you. No, I always tread around this question carefully because I think well-intentioned people will often offer that advice. And sometimes I suppose it does work. But most of the time, if you are seeing a student struggle in kindergarten with reading, if you're seeing a student struggle in first grade, it is not going to get better without increasing the intensity of instruction, increasing the ratio, you know, one-to-one versus one to small group or a whole class. And the longer that it takes for that instruction to be provided, the further your student is going to fall behind. Those of us in the science of reading field are well familiar with the Matthew effect. You know, kids who love reading read a lot, and then they read more, and then they just are learning all these words and all these concepts and this knowledge, and kids who struggle with reading are not. So their peer is reading, you know, the history of wetlands in the United States, and they're reading a decodable book because they're struggling with reading and it doesn't have the same content knowledge. So it's really important when your child is struggling with reading, thank the teacher or the kind-hearted person who's giving you that advice, but then ask for that district evaluation. Listen to that voice that says, no, my student needs more, and work on finding that support. You know, ask what else the school can provide, because the longer it takes for your student to get that help, the more they will fall behind. And it's so hard to make up that lost time and that lost knowledge.
And I'm such a proponent too. I know you are too, of that early intervention, because the sooner we flag it, the sooner that we can help them and make sure that we fill those gaps so that there's not going to be so many gaps later down the road.
Yes, absolutely. It definitely, it's waiting is not recommended. The school has to have more supports. What needs to happen for the child to be evaluated for those supports? Those are the questions to ask as soon as you, as a parent, are concerned that your student is struggling with learning to read.
Yeah. And so if a parent requests that type of evaluation, or maybe even a school has some type of screening process, are there any next steps even after that?
I mean, I think here's where it goes school by school, but typically in my area, at least, if you request a complete educational evaluation, that will be done by the school district. It usually involves psychological evaluation, IQ. If you are concerned about reading, I recommend you request a phonological assessment. In my area, the CTOP is usually the one that's done. But if you do not specifically request that, in my experience, it won't necessarily be done, even though you're concerned about reading. And then if you're concerned about your child's handwriting, request an occupational therapy evaluation. If you are concerned about your child's speech, request a speech evaluation. You know, request all the things. They may not come back with anything, but I can say from my own experience, when my child was in preschool, I didn't see a need to request occupational therapy, and my child did need it, and that just cost us some time because then it had to be resubmitted. So ask for all the things at one time, and then when that meeting is held, if your child is not going to qualify for an IEP or further support through that route, you can then ask, what are the other options? What else could we do?
That's helpful. And then we're going to tap into your expertise here too. So how can parents or maybe educators differentiate between general reading struggles and then a more specific learning disability like dyslexia?
So I think that's really, again, I think this is sort of a sticky topic, because I think so many times teachers feel constrained by what the curriculum demands their school requires and things like that, and they're afraid of making a mistake, being wrong. So I think this is something teachers sort of have to feel out for themselves. I think teachers will know what supports their school has. You know, is there a committee that they can collect data and submit the data for that committee to evaluate whether there's, you know, small group reading instruction? I know some schools are starting to provide flex time in the day where different kids can be broken out according to different skills. you know, that wouldn't require anything at all necessarily. It would just require a teacher to know this student is struggling with this and this student's struggling with that. I would never want to tell a teacher they should approach a parent about their concerns if every dynamic is different, every relationship is different. But I certainly think when parents are concerned, they absolutely should raise it to their child's teacher, because it just brings that concern forward. And then the teacher should know what options might be available at the school level, even without a formal evaluation. I really encourage families to get that school evaluation, because it doesn't cost a thing, unlike private evaluations, and it does provide information. And I actually have a handout to help parents write that request, you know, a free resource. So I will send you that link if you want to include it for anyone that wants help with that process.
Amazing. We could definitely link that in the show notes. And it just reinforces the fact it's so important for schools to be using a structured literacy approach so that all kids are going to get the instruction that they need. And you know, I think a lot of parents need more support in knowing what to do, what protocols to follow. And so, you know, Heather is your go-to person for that. For any educator or parent listening who wants to better recognize or respond to dyslexia, along with this special toolkit that you have to offer, what's another piece of advice that you just want to leave?
I would say, you know, listen to that little voice that's saying, you know, I truly believe parents know their kids really well. And I can say that from my own experience as a special needs parent who's been in the system. My child is in high school, so I've been doing this a long time for my child. Listen to that voice. Teachers are wonderful. They have wonderful professional experience, but they don't know your child the way you know your child. And if your voice is saying, we need something more, we're not getting enough, listen to that. And then have that conversation with your child's teacher. Ask what other supports. It's not a quick process. You're not going to have one meeting and everything's going to fall right into place, unfortunately, in my experience. But just starting the trail, building the relationships, letting the teacher know you are already concerned is going to help the teacher sort of analyze and collect data perhaps a little bit differently than if it's just all the kids and it's the beginning of the year data and things like that. So I really think parents have a great voice and a great insight on their child, and their description of their child's needs will help a school community better meet them, if that makes sense.
100%. This has been so wonderful, Heather. I appreciate all of the insight that you have to share. And I think it's really empowering for parents to become better advocates for their own children if some red flags arise at home and they're seeking supports and unsure of where to turn to. So this has been such a valuable episode. And I know if you're in the upstate New York area and you have any of these concerns, you'll want to scope out some of Heather's in-person offerings. But how else can listeners connect with you virtually?
Oh, gosh. Okay. So anyone is welcome to visit our website at www.newpulsemultisensory.com. We do offer in-person and online tutoring. So if you're not local to New Pulse, we can still help you out.
There we go.
Oh, yeah. We have online as well. And then I am on Facebook and Instagram at New Pulse Multisensory Tutoring. And we have a TPT store. We have a website store. And I will give you some links. And we also have a writing membership for teachers. And we also have a membership for parents of kids with dyslexia who want to learn more about what they need to learn to advocate for their child. So we have that as well. You can email me at heather.o'donnell, newpulsemultisensory.com. And I will be happy to help you out. I love advocating and working with parents. It's something I've had to do as myself as a parent, and I think it's just so important. So I'm happy to help anyone who's looking to chat.
Wonderful. We'll put that all in the show notes. And I hope everyone who has these needs arising taps into your resources, because I know they are truly a treasure. So thank you again for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I love talking about this, and it's been a wonderful chance to chat.
Thank you so much for tuning into Literacy in Color. I hope today's episode left you feeling both inspired and equipped with something new to add to your teaching toolkit. If you're enjoying this podcast, it would truly mean so much to me if you'd leave a 5-star review. It helps other educators find the show and join our colorful community. And don't forget to hit the follow or subscribe button so you never miss an episode. For more tips, tools, and resources, Be sure to check out the links in the show notes at michelleandthecolorfulclassroom.com. Thanks again for listening, and I'll catch you next week. Until then, be colorful and teach colorfully.